Okay, good afternoon, everyone. You have been here for a long day, but on the other hand, you can think of that you didn't come in vain to Jyväskylä, so you got some compensation for your travel and research money. That's good. Okay, so I thought to give a talk. You can interrupt me, please. We can discuss also later about the kind of multifactorial risk perspective for the learning difficulties. I think it's an important topic, and I'm really happy what Barbara gave the talk. Many of the things what she said, I don't need to repeat now. So we think of neurocognitive disorders that is kind of one of the key issues both in the child brain and in predictable. So I thought that I'll first just briefly go through them, and we should keep then at the same time in mind that do these neurocognitive disorders, from the current cognitive neuroscience point of view, do they represent like separate categorical diagnosis, or are they a dimensions of certain skills, and they are only at the low end of a certain skill level, or do they actually or are they actually more like a different type of organization of the neural systems? And then I'll briefly present what multiple risk factor perspective means. And there's a new approach relatively recently launched by National Institute of Mental Health, so-called RDoC approach. I'll describe it briefly, and we looked at a couple of web pages. And then I thought just to briefly skim through the current type of evidence for this. And then we have end up with the discussions and conclusions. Okay, so first of all, this is the slide I've been showing also in some of my other lectures, that I want us to, it's a very simple one, to think of our lifespan from birth to finally going away to the other side of the Jordan, and then thinking that what we have. We have like a developing cognition or psyche, if you like. You can think of this in different ways. For example, just being the kind of interaction with the environment. But we have here definitely like a certain aspects, social, cognitive, and bodily aspects, and all of these aspects are actually very important. And then these mold and develop, if you like, in very complex interaction between environment and genes, and in a kind of a spiral-like fashion. But then we can think of also that there's a developmental frame for this development of becoming persons with certain skill profiles and so on. There's a typical development that follows, but then the question is that is there really like a deviant develop that leads to a like a deviant or complete organization? And we know that clearly if you are certain big genetic changes in certain chromosomes like fragile X Down syndrome, that's clearly caused by certain relatively big mutation. So that's an easy case, but now we're talking about a little bit more subtle cases. So I'll touch upon reading problems. I actually don't need to read it here. I actually don't spend time, so we save some time. So I will make these slides available so you can read yourselves later on. We've been discussing about that. Barbara talked about language impairments. I have avoided purposefully to use terms dyslexia and SLI here. And then I will just very briefly also touch upon attentional problems. And I guess here I use the term ADHD, also probably we should skip also this. But typically, this is perhaps not so familiar, so we just mentioned briefly that it's a broad range. It's between 1 to 20% in population, depending on the in different studies. And this has a bearing also on the topic we are talking. So symptoms are rather normally distributed in the population, and therefore the medical people, when they do diagnosis, it's often definition of the threshold. So this wide variation in itself shows that it's probably not easily an easy category to say that the person has ADHD. So, but typical processes where problems occur are in directing attention, maintaining attention, related to so-called vigilance in neuropsychology, and organization and execution problems. We'll come back to the neural spaces here more, and impulse control and arousal state regulation also. And it also touches actually on emotions quite a bit, because these people have often difficulty in controlling feelings. And what is important from our topic point of view is that below 20% of the kids who have this diagnosis, only 20% have only this diagnosis, or 80% have at least one other learning difficulty. So Barbara mentioned this also already, so we just remind ourselves that all of learning difficulties are highly comorbid. That means that they co-occur together. Now the question will remain in our minds that whether they represent really different type of brain organizations completely, or are they part of the in different types of continuums, and how do we think of this intersection between them? Okay, so that's the kind of things we would think about, but I'll introduce you very briefly two kind of related approaches for thinking about this. It's multiple risk factor perspective and then this RDoC perspective. So, this Bruce Pennington has been one of the key persons kind of advocating the idea of the multiple deficit model for learning disorders. And we will actually see later on review one of the papers where he actually tested the existence of either single deficit or multiple deficit models. But the idea is relatively simple. We have different levels of analysis, and we can think of that at the etiologic, as the very basic level, we have kind of a genetic level, etiologic risk factors and protective factors, but there are also always environmental factors also involved. So we talk about, for example, gene-environment interaction and their correlations also with each other. So this is at one level. Then we have to think of neural systems level, that is how these genes and environment affect different types of perceptual, sensory, and higher order neural systems when they develop. So this is something we can measure from the brain. Indirectly, we also measure cognitive processes with the brain tools. And then we have here a different level, and they all interact with each other. And then we have complex behavioral disorders, for example, reading problems, attentional problems, language problems, and so on. Now we look at a little bit here also in the verbal sense. But before we go there, I should say that there should be, of course, arrows between the levels as well, but it would have made the model too complicated for them to draw. So we mentioned already the first one. So at the neural systems levels, it's important to realize that a single genetic or environmental risk factor will often actually affect more than one neural system. So this is called pleiotropy. But on the other hand, it's also important to notice that even one single neural risk factor will actually have cascading, you can say, downstream or upstream effects on the development of other neural systems. So the development of different neural systems actually depend on each other to some extent. So this is at a very general level. And then at the cognitive level, we can think of that when cognitive constructs like reading skills or their prior language skills, or that can be then subdivided to other constructs, they are often correlated because the developmental pathways overlap. And this kind of, at the cognitive level, the overlap, this will then lead to comorbidity at the symptom level. So this is what Barbara was talking about when she mentioned that maybe SLI and dyslexia share some cognitive level deficits together. So they would be comorbidity in that case. Now, if you think of, like, typically when we were thinking of dyslexia as being, for example, that there's a core deficit or phonological deficit, that was the era of phonological deficit for dyslexia, then there was also those who had rapid automatic naming problems, and so we were thinking that there's actually double dissociation and there are two different types. So this would be the single deficit model idea, but multiple deficit model thinks that in terms of partial overlap of the problems. And one note on the symptom level is that comorbidity means then that there's this greater than chance by or chance co-occurrence. Okay, now we need to go here. This RDoC approach is a kind of a bit more recent, and I can't remember exactly when was first launched, but and I'm not going to go there. You can check this link here. It's became as a framework for new approaches for investigating mental disorders. So the idea was that researchers should look, rather than just diagnostic categories, they should look at more like different domains, like that integrate many levels of information, starting from genomics, brain function, and circuits, brain circuits as well, to behavior, and even they have self-reports they use. And the goal here is to understand the nature and dimensions of functioning in the full range of human behavior, from normal to abnormal behavior, and then varying degrees of dysfunctions in either psychological or biological systems. So the key idea is quite similar to multi-feature approach, that psychopathologies or developmental disorders are dimensional, and that there is no like a sharp line dividing different categories, and normalcy is not often even present. But they don't claim to be a system for diagnostic guide, at least at this point. So what are these RDoC constructs then? Let's visit quickly. This works, the website here. There's a whole web page related to the National Institute of Mental Health, so you might want to take a look. There's a good resources related to this. And they have taken different, you could think of them as domains. There are valence systems. They talk about negative and positive valence systems, and these include like acute threat, fear, or potential threat, and sustained threat, and so on. We are not actually ourselves studying too much this side, so I don't spend here too much time. What is more familiar perhaps to us are the cognitive systems. And at the construct level, they talk about more like attention, which we also study, perception. We have here many perceptual systems we are studying. And then you can see that they are actually taking relatively kind of low-level processes in some cases. And then, of course, attention is it's a higher-level thing. And then including working memory. And it, what is evident here also that you can actually see that they are still lacking quite a bit of precision here or subdivision. But then they, in the same line, include social processes and arousal and regulatory systems. So the idea would be to cover all kind of processing systems in the a human biological organism, if you like. We may take a look at, for example, auditory perception here. Then they first, they have, you can here look at then the different levels like molecular level and even certain receptor level, serotonin system, glutamate and so on. And then you can look at the cell level, how these things are developed, and neuronal circuits might be interesting for us. And then they have physiological descriptions. And you can see that, for example, for the auditory system, we know that they are lacking several, for example, brain measures, which they mention some here. So this is under development yet, and it's not like complete one. But if you, we don't take now time to click on under each one of these, but you can then go there yourself. Then another way to look at this is they have developed this type of RDoC matrix, and it's there also. And this is also the, they have, here are the same domains, negative valence systems and positive valence systems, and the cognitive systems. And you can, from this matrix also, then go deeper and look into the several systems. And for example, you could pick up some language and certain elements, then you could look here and see how it's, how it, and physiology, we have only anterior negative N400 and P600. These are the well-known, quite common components and ERPs for it. But then they try to define the behavior in teams in terms of these different, like, weightings for different cognitions and processes. So we might, for example, take attention and see how they actually divide attention and then attentional problems. And here they first, we don't go there now, but they give a definition of what attention means. And then they try to describe attention in the cognitive and neural systems level. I have kind of picked up the key points here. For example, many brain systems are competing for control of attention, including perceptual, cognitive, motivational, and emotional systems. So they include various aspects and think that all of these actually compete for our control of attention. And then if there are changes in the priority in this competition, then this will lead to modulation of local circuit interactions in the brain with target regions. So the regions that are important or due to this prioritization, then they either lead to enhancement or suppression. So of attentional control. So like implementation of selection is the term they use here. And it's important to note that actually many systems affect the control of attention. So it's like motivational, inputs. They think in at the brain level. They come from hypothalamus or limbic system, for example, hunger or sexual drive or so on. They can be important at the motivational level, controlling attention. Salient sensory inputs, we know, like P300, ERP is one clear example of such thing, and reward system and emotion systems in the brain. So they think of like attentional deficit then arising because either of failures of attentional control or attentional this implementation or kind of selection. So there's no correct way, for example, enhance or suppress attention. And this would be then leading to attentional deficits. So these are at the neural and cognitive level system factors. Then saliency, I don't talk about this more, but bottom-up and top-down processes have their own important role. So, for example, top-down processes would be direction of attention or control of attention by means of representations for the goals of what we want to do and task relevance. And at the circuit level, then attention is influencing, like, for feed-forward transmission of information through the sensory systems, and there are also the local circuit processing with specific brain regions that are related to control for attention. And then they describe also how attention is related to other domains and constructs. And in this way, actually, they are trying to describe all other domains as well. So I think that it would be really worthwhile to take a look and try to understand, and it's a good kind of scheme for yourself to go through these different levels there. But we don't dwell more on that now. There was also just a nice illustration, a bit difficult for me even to understand what was meant with this, but I guess the idea is that there's no perhaps linear relationship between these different levels of explanation. So they have these different domains in the RDoC approach, and then units of analysis also, whether it's at the molecular level, genetic level, or so on. They have rather complex interaction. And what this article is criticizing about the RDoC approach is that they have not included development well enough into the whole description system, which needs to be there. Okay, let's then keep these two multiple feature idea and then this RDoC approach in mind at the background, and then look at what we kind of, what type of evidence there arises from the research. And Barbara actually touched upon this already, I just mentioned briefly, that language processes, they actually involve both language-specific elements, for example, phonological development. We heard about different type of trochaic structure or features being more dominant in some languages rather than others. There's also overlap with other cognitive domains with the language systems, perception being obvious one. And the various cognitive components also interact bidirectionally, so in both ways in language processing. And I guess the main point for our discussion is that brain mechanisms that serve language, they are rather highly distributed in the network-wide fashion in the brain. They're highly interactive also, and these have their own develop. Each of these mechanisms have their own developmental timetable that are tied to each other as well. And people have tried to define developmental language disorders, for example, with certain specific brain localization, but this has failed. And there have been described also, at least in the classical neuropsychological definition of language disorders, there was expressive, receptive, and then there were also something related to naming and so on. But these subtypes of developmental disorders have had considerable overlap, and the borders of them have not been very clear either. All of this is very understandable if we take a look at briefly how language is represented in the brain. Hickok and Pöppel have published good papers. This is from the Nature Reviews, and it's a very schematic view describing the language systems. And of course, for us, it would start perhaps with the development of the auditory system very early already, and some of it already before the birth. And then the phonological system network here in the mid, post, and superior temporal sulcus, and also some other parts here at the temporal parietal junction being related. For this, I think they are linking this for the conceptual network. And then we have sensory motor interface, and then the parietal superior temporal area, and then here the rather classical Broca's area, and then here lexical interface for language, and then combinatorial network in the more in the anterior part of the temporal lobe. But then you can see that these are very highly interacting with each other, the systems. And in all cases, the arrows are bidirectional. Of course, the information does not flow through the arrows in the brain. There has to be something else. So here's, I just picked up a couple of examples from the literature. So here was Pnas, Sauer et al. They compared repetition of pseudo-words and pseudo-words to kind of a lower level of perceptional level, you might think, and then listening to sentences, real sentences versus pseudo-word sentences, and they were able to differentiate the kind of involvement of brain areas. And you can see that the kind of perceptual level is more here at the auditory areas and then this more frontal areas here. And you have a kind of wider area coming up for the parietal areas, important also for attention, for the sentence comprehension. And I guess the point to keep in mind all the time is that we are talking here also of relatively complex networks, and this is only some sort of grand average picture. If we would see individuals here depicted as some sort of film or something, then we would recognize that the picture is much more complicated in each individual brain in terms of these areas being involved. Now, in this same article, they also then found that there are two kind of anatomical pathways, which one of them being like quite familiar, or both of them perhaps being familiar to us, is the arcuate fasciculus here being the kind of a dorsal pathway. And then they suggested language is preferentially mediated by these one of these streams. So sublexical pseudo-word repetition, for example, was more related to this dorsal, whereas the higher level sentence comprehension more for this ventral pathway that is more longitudinal also. But they also acknowledge that in the real speech, these systems and pathways interact in verbal communication. And I don't want to go through the details here. You can take a look yourself. Okay, but so that's just a couple of examples from the language processing system in the brain. Now, reading comprehension, I picked up this Pennington's book, Explaining Abnormal Behavior. Very good, simple reading, actually. If you want to learn more about this type of things, then please read this book. And, well, this just illustrates us that reading comprehension, if you think, what does it require? It requires different skill levels. Fluent printed words is the typical kind of word recognition skills, listening comprehension skills, of course, and then also there are discourse-specific comprehension skills. And what we have learned a lot in the reading literature and reading research is that print word recognition skill, there would be like a subdivision of two main kind of coding strategies, phonological coding or more whole word orthographic coding. And then if you think at the endophenotype level or precursor level for these disorders, you would have phoneme awareness being more linked to phonological coding and rapid serial naming. Because does everybody know what rapid serial naming means? I guess you do, right? Someone does not know what is rapid serial naming. Even for the people who are, it's a simple task, I mean, who you are a methodologist here, it's a simple task where you have five objects you know for sure, you have them in rows, and then you have 10 items, and then you have five rows, and you have to name these familiar names as fast as you can. And for some reason, for some people, it takes much longer time to reach at the end to name these familiar objects. And they're 100% familiar for people. This is tested beforehand. And this kind of some sort of, there's some kind of stickiness either related to access or something. People are not quite sure what this task really is measuring. But this typically is related to reading fluency and here in Pennington's idea in the orthographic coding. And then listening, we can understand that phonological memory relates to it, your size of vocabulary, how many words you know, and your syntactic skills. Okay, so now here we come. This is then the same thing, more or less, displayed at the brain level. And we have here equally complex system for the written language. So we have spoken language, written language, and if you think of these language systems and evolution, which one was first? This was a wake-up question, if anybody tried to sleep. So which one was, of course we know, it was spoken language was first. And you can actually see that the brain is not like inventing completely new areas. So the brain tries to work in an economical way, and it uses the same brain areas for different types of tasks, if it can. So this is a kind of a general idea. And therefore you see that the many of the same systems, like of course when you hear, you don't need the primary visual areas, which you need for reading. But then the next system here, already we have two important systems, ventral occipital temporal region, so-called visual word form area, or like Stanislas Dehaene called this brain's letterbox, and then there's a more anterior fusiform region. And you remember in the previous slide, like this area was more for the lexical access for spoken language. And then we have this anterior temporal region, they think it's access to meaning, and then the frontal areas are also involved in reading. And then we have this kind of system that is related to access to pronunciation and articulation, and here we can already almost see that there's an arcuate fasciculus, this bundle of white matter tracts that is important. And by the way, it has been related to also music and musicality, this one here. And then we have here top-down attention and processes related not only to serial reading, but reading in general. Okay, it's not important for our purposes now to know all of these details. You can study them later on, they will be very interesting, at least to me. Now, here's another just visualization of the same thing. So, and I like this few sentences by Stanislas. When learning to read, left ventral visual areas increase activation and specialization. So it's a developmental process as well, what happens actually at the brain level. And there's a massive bundle then that links this visual system to the phonological coding or auditory speech system, areas that are related to spoken language. Now, what is interesting in this case is that those who have reading problems, here I guess the term dyslexic, actually it also depends a bit of the language transparency. If it's a highly transparent language versus more shallow orthography, that means it's not, the deep orthography, so when you have more complex, so like English or French. What you can see that in this row here, these purple spots display what is under activation in dyslexics in both cases of transparent and more complex orthography. But you can see here that there's a slightly different areas. And in some areas, they also have overactivation here if you have reading problems. But the main point here was also to show that it actually depends a little bit on the material that you read also and how you have been learning to read in certain language systems. Now, let's take a look at a bit closer look for an interesting area in related to reading. And this is visual word form area, or fusiform perhaps better. And these different type of stimuli activate this area. This is from the side view, and this is from the top of the head. And this is depicted in different colors. It's very nicely illustrated here. You can see that if you have the inner area, it's activated for the objects, houses. And then we have certain area for a bit of different type of objects. And then we have one area for faces, and there's one area here that is activated for the words. So there are slight, we cannot with EEG or MEG see these type of differences, but in fMRI this is possible. And this area is interesting in the sense that, roughly speaking, the same broad area is used for different perceptual purposes. And also the laterality of this area has its own different developmental timetables. So one example is that this is initially bilateral before learning to read for the faces, but then it kind of shifts a bit more to the right hemisphere, if I remember right, the laterality. And one idea is that because word reading kind of preoccupies parts of this area, then it becomes in then when you learn to read, then the reading becomes there so important that this there becomes kind of right lateralization for faces. Now, here is an example if we compare those with the reading problems, that for the words, you can see that they have almost similar to 9-year-old good reader and dyslexic reader, but there's this area that was activated for the words. This is clearly not activated, depending, of course, on the thresholds in the study for significance and so on, but here not as clearly activated. Otherwise, the maps, activation maps, look quite similar. Now, there are also certain these white matter tracks, and these bundles have been shown. There are two types of studies by Maike, whom you many know, and who is one of our collaborators from Köyö Löven. has been doing with Jan Wouters and Paul Sesquier, who will come tomorrow work on these might matter tracks. And we have a person who is doing the with Icometrics, the I guess you're developing this type of analysis pipelines to be as accurate as possible here. But here it has been shown that this left arcuate and there's also this longitudinal tracks, they would be different in adult dyslexics. Okay, now, what time is it? Okay, let me check time. Okay. Now we present few examples from Jyväskylä longitudinal study of dyslexia and from completely different. So we've been looking more like anatomical systems for language and reading. And now we look here a bit of how what kind of results we find. And this has been the data that we started to collect long time ago. And Jarmo has been working on this data with me and Kaisa has been working with us and publishing her dissertation paper recently on this data. So we followed about 200 families, at half of them at risk and half were control families. And then we had at various points brain ERP measurements. So I just present one particular study here, is that we measured 6-month-olds. And then we try to see if the brain responses at 6 months old can, in fact, predict later pre-reading skills that are quite typical. We also see here the cognitive skills that are typically atypical in dyslexic children, and then how they relate to later reading speed at 8th grade. And here we have the measurements. We don't have two big samples here, so there's some, I think you have to be a bit cautious, I guess, with the results, but they have been, many of our studies have shown very similar results to each other, so we believe this to be a true result. And the pre-reading skills before school age were phonological skills. This was composite score of several skills. Rapid automatic naming was also one of the measures. And we measured the classical verbal short-term memory and letter knowledge. So these are the most typical skills at the cognitive level linked to reading. And then we also, to get a of reading speed, a very robust measure, we had a oral text reading and pseudo-word text reading. So if I would read Spanish or Italian, for example, I could read it quite well and you would understand what I read if you know Italian or Spanish, but I would not understand myself anything what I read. So that's a pseudo word text reading and then word list reading. Okay, what we found in this study, Kaisa did this analysis, so we found that in the control children there's no relationship between your brain response at the for the repeated standard. This was a pseudo word ata, 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 and occasionally replaced by with a long consonant atta. And but we just the most robust measure turned out to be this response to this short ata with a short gap. And here we can see that there's a clear correlation in the at-risk sample, such that those who have high amplitude have also better phonological skills. So this is an Z-score, is a kind of average based on the control group, about 100 kids. And so here we have then much, I mean, these samples are smaller here, but this is based on the whole JLD sample of 100 control children. And for rapid automatic naming, it's a, perhaps a bit surprising that actually there is also a small correlation in the control group, and it explains this amplitude. So the bigger response means faster rapid automatic naming time, about 15% of the skills, whereas in the risk group, we explain about 44% by this brain response. So there is some kind of peculiar relationship between brain response and later rapid automatic naming. And then for the reading, the response, here we have now, again, the CET score based on the controls, and we have 8 graders, and we can see the same linear relationship in that risks, but not in the controls here. Now, so bigger negative amplitude meant faster reading, but only in the at-risk group. And then when Kaiser did this type of path analysis, found out that yes, there is a direct correlation, but if you enter rapid automatic naming at the preschool age into the picture, then the explanation goes via this rapid automatic naming. So something in the brain development is affecting the system. Downstream has a cascading effect on the brain system that is responsible for rapid automatic naming. And if rapid automatic naming relates somehow to lexical access, then this brain system that we measure at 6 months is also somehow related to this. Either the building up of the representations is not good so that they could be accessed, or even during the recording itself, there could be some sort of indirect measure of accessing these representations that have been built up, but they share some common variants then that relates to later reading. So I think don't fully, at least I don't understand why particularly we ran this, but this is not the important point actually as such, but it's rather to think of these multi-levels, different systems that might be related to reading and reading problems. Now, there are a bunch of other, we have seen anatomical differences, but there are, for example, auditory speech perception problems, both SLI and dyslexia has been implicated, and there's a kind, I don't, Jarmo has been doing more and studies related to entrainment, that is how the brain systems actually follow quite faithfully the stimulus properties, and that might be related to speech perception in all of us, and if there's a problem there, then related to dyslexia and SLI. So this could lead to weak phoneme representations, and this could then hamper then learning grapheme phoneme correspondence learning. And we might mention here that one way to try to tap this would be that if you have problems in processing, for example, foreign language, this could be related to poor speech sound representations. And actually, Nasla has a poster about this topic, so please visit her poster from the Predictable project. So then there are also tons of researchers who have suggested that the problems lie more perhaps at the higher linguistic level than at this perceptual level. But I guess a bunch of evidence suggests that you have problems occurring at the both levels. Now, I mean, this would be just a very simple visual diagrammic view how things might work, and that would be that speech perception affects how your long-term memory traces are built up, and these, in a top-down fashion, your representations at early age, already when the infants start to, after babbling and start to name words and so on, the way they have built up representations would affect already then how they perceive new auditory or speech information. And then all of this complex system would then affect phonemic representations and then we can come only to the level when we talk about phoneme or phonological awareness. But below that, there are a lot of systems that affect the whole thing. And then this, then it would be one prerequisite for fluent grapheme phoneme conversion and learning to decode text. Now, one interesting thing to point out, however, that these are group-level results. We saw already in the scatter plots that not everybody from the risk families, and if we had plotted their dyslexic children, we would also have seen that not everyone actually have this type of auditory problems. So we know that there's a review that was data collected by one of our former doctoral students, and Jarmo was the first author. We wrote a systematic review of auditory processing deficits, and we found that in the literature, it's basically from 33 to 52% of children with dyslexia suffer from these type of problems, not all. And this is a key point, as we will show later on. There are other important issues, interest in reading, vocabulary, working memory, lexical access, and visual attention that also play a role. And actually, there are good reviews also, so I just mentioned a few of the results. Visual attentional deficit has been implicated. For example, sluggish attention could impair encoding of spatial position in the text. And there has been suggested that also visual attentional orienting problems, and this might impair word identification and encoding of memory traces. Also, in the auditory domain, it has been suggested that there are some attentional problems which may impair speech processing. Then we have this punch of this, that it's not probably auditory or visual system issue. It's more like a cross-modal processing issue. And difficulty, for example, in shifting attention between modalities. They have been doing this type of very experimental studies when you have to switch attention from auditory to visual stimuli and vice versa. And dyslexics have problems here. And Leo Blumert and colleagues from Holland has been showing, and Van Attevelt, that there is indeed this type of atypical letter speech sound integration also in dyslexics. Okay, so we've looked at a little bit of the language and reading network. Let's just now look a little bit of the attention networks, and some people are doing here also work. And then how this relates to the people with attentional problems. Here are some areas that have been implicated and suggested to be important in attention. And we have ventrolateral prefrontal cortex, dorsolateral prefrontal cortex, and parietal cortex. And then here in the inside the brain, in the this larger area actually that involves so-called cingulate cortex, but dorsal anterior mid-cingulate cortex has been implicated to be in a kind of gateway in attention. And there's also the inner structures, striatum here, that is involved in attention. In some cases also cerebellum is important in direction of attention. And by the way, for dyslexia, there was, which we don't talk about now much, more was the cerebellum hypothesis by Rod Nicholson, who suggested that dyslexics have problems in directing their eyes properly because of dysfunction in the cerebellum. Now, attention consists of different subcomponents. We know that it has actually I guess originally Mike Posner has been an influential person here. Alerting involves certain areas, right frontal areas, but also superior parietal lobe. And orienting, shifting attention to a different location, frontal eye fields are important, and also temporoparietal junction for them. And then there's an executive attention that relates for inhibition and attention control, and this is more by the prefrontal cortex, and anterior cingulate is here important. Now, I just show this to show that that was a schematic picture. Then they have been actually doing in various studies, like orienting, as they have been found in the fMRI studies. Peterson and Posner have been doing the attention system of the brain. And executive control, similarly. There are other different areas, but we don't need to pay attention to these. But just pay attention to the fact that actually, when we come to these higher processes, there's equally complex network in the brain involved. Now, these are the kind of circuits what people have been describing. Here is another article I found by, can't even say the Perper or Quill, something like that. And it's not only the time of the day, but the difficulty of really pronouncing this. So you can see here in the green, we have so-called quite classical at frontal parietal attentional network. And there are certain systems that are important here, like frontal cerebellar network also. And then we have here for the frontal striatal network. And then we have also for the alerting system here. Also, and the reward network is involved also with the frontal network here. We know that reticular activation formation here is also related to arousal control, and that may have something to do with the alerting system. Okay, so there are multiple systems in the brain that and seems to be also affected in all of these disorders. Now let's look at a bit of genetic evidence. Also, this picture just becomes a bit more complicated, I think. But I think that we as researchers have to face the complexity, not only behavior, but the human brain behavior, if you like. Well, this was actually mentioned already by Barbara, so we go just mention quickly that in the kind of behavioral genetic studies, it has been found that if you have dyslexic first degree relatives, I mean identical twins, have the most almost similar, they're genetically identical, so they actually co-occurrence of reading problems occur in 44% to 62%. And in terms of non-word reading problems, in even in 75%. So it's this suggests high heritability, but not 100%. And in the same way, Barbara also mentioned that we have this familial component in the SLI, language impairments. But note that the percentage actually is here much higher, I mean the variation and the range, compared to the dyslexia cases. And it might be that there is something related to either the definition of language impairments or else, I don't know if it's the real phenomenon or is it mainly kind of definition issue, but social complexity is perhaps a bit bigger even in language problems. Now, Jarmo had been preparing some nice slides, so I borrowed from him. And we have here our chromosome set, and there are certain candidate genes that are known to be affected in dyslexia. DYX1C1 was the first one. DCDC2, they are both related to neural migration and white matter volume. KIA is related also to neural migration and white matter volume. You can see that they are residing in different chromosomes. And RoBo1 related to axonal guidance and interhemispheric processing, inhibition there. And then there was relatively kind of newer one related to cortical responses to speech, frontotemporal connectivity. And this just shows where these different so-called candidate genes are located in these chromosomes. We don't need to go into detail. Let's see here. It's just one example. This is quite old slide already, suggesting that in animal studies, when they disrupted the functioning of these genes, they found that the normal migration at early in brain development was interrupted when the functioning of the gene was interrupted. So having clear genetic contribution. And these interruptions are related closely, so-called ectopic or malformation in the brain development that was initially found by Albert Calaburda, 85, in the autopsy studies of dyslexic adults. So there are more of these ectopic formations in dyslexics. Now, this is a example of in the human dyslexic, the kind of ectopic formation. So this is thought to be migration disorder where the brain cells have traveled a bit too high in the cortical layers here. And if you do disrupt in rats the functioning of DYX1C1, for example, you will get quite similar type of disorder. And this was also quite a long time ago already published by Albert Calaburda and his colleagues, suggesting that maybe this type of functioning could be related to dyslexic brain as well. Of course, there's a long jump from here to understand how this ectopic formation might be related to graphene-phonin correspondence, for example. Now, Juha Keres associates, Juha Kere is a molecular geneticist, and he studied people and their molecular genetics, but the colleagues studied also these white matter tracts between this phonologically related area and the temporal lobe, and they found that there is a relationship between the white matter volume and certain of these candidate genes, but the relationship goes via the white matter volume. So these genes do not have a direct relationship to reading, but it has a relationship to white matter volume and these white matter bundles, and then that has a relationship to reading. And now this is another paper from the same group, also the same candidate genes. And they are actually looking at just single base pairs that are called SNPs within these genes, DYX1C1 and DCDC2 and KIA. And then you can see that there's a bit different brain areas affected, whether you have more like a typical kind of variant in this base pair versus atypical variant. And you can see, for example, this KIA has affected quite some of the typical areas what we would be relating to phonological processing, for example. Now, this picture, I'm not going to go through these genes, so don't worry. This is just to show that nowadays more and more evidence is coming up with the new genes. For example, I was involved in one neurodiversity study where they have found just very recently new kind of gene for rapid automatic naming. Now, one important point of these genetic studies is that a single kind of SNP variant, for example, explain very, very small amount of variance in reading only. So they are not kind of good direct predictors of reading. Now you have start to probably get the picture that you need to have a bundle of these genes to be affecting to any behavior. Maybe not one single gene of this is capable of doing. And now remind yourselves that I mentioned that in certain cases like fragile X or Down syndrome, these are big chromosome changes, and then even one single change is affecting malformation, maybe a little bit of the facial and face expression and many cognitive functions. But here we are talking about much more subtle effects. Now, this is an old paper also already, and this shows that there are actually with so-called speech sound disorder and reading disorder, there are actually some shared genes. This Dix locations, like Dix1C1 is here, and this is so chromosome regions, certain that are the same, and then some of the candidate genes are shared also. But they are not, SLI, at least at that point, did not have directly kind of shared variants at the genetic basis. Do you, Jarmo, remember if SLI has more recently found some common genes or SNPs with dyslexia, SLI as such? Does anyone know this in the audience? But at least for speech sound disorder, that is specifically diagnosed in US, and it has something to do with the language impairment. Now, this is too crowded, don't go through. This is just an impression to show that these are the genetic factors found in the ADHD, and you can see that actually here are different dopaminergic genes, non-adrenergic genes, serotoninergic genes, and other candidate genes. And here they have, in the meta-analysis they just studied, it's a positive meta-analysis. In some cases, no. In some cases, they have a positive result for this gene. And I did not find any here that would be similar genes with the ADHD. But you also remember that the neural networks were quite different. And yet, there is high comorbidity between dyslexia and ADHD then. I don't know how they've been done. Then I found this one interesting paper. It's actually the same paper in Uakkil. And they pointed out that if you have here, for example, a genome of an unaffected person, gene from A to N, and then there are risk variants that are found in genome of ADHD patients. So they thought that this would be one mechanism. I think this is important also for our discussion. And there, each rare variant, so like in this base bears these SNPs, if they are a bit different, different persons might have a bit different variant. And then they relate to coding of proteins, A, B, D. And then they think that each rare variant induces a similar intermediate phenotype. So in other cases, we call it endophenotype. So there would be change in dendritic spine morphogenesis and synaptic function, for example. So it's not necessarily that there's only one type of variant that relates to one type of dysfunction. Okay, here just to point out that they have been studying also the socioeconomic status effects on the Fusimor brain activation. And here we can see, for example, for the word left word of words, we don't hear this line, and this blue line is normal CES and the low CES families, and we don't see much difference between them, whereas the dyslexics independently coming from the low CES or high CES, they have a similar type of low activation. So at least in this case, the CES does not seem to be playing the major role or being the major causal effect. Now, I picked up this from the last year's British Dyslexia Association meeting, one slide. I stole it, took a photo, and show it to you. Is this, Robert, correct to do? Is this open science or... But I'm at least showing it. So I found this highly interesting. This is status on learning, and here's average rank of test score. This could be any kind of skill method. And it here's age in months. So we have 120 months here. And you can see that here you can have a low SES and high SES family, initially high score, and then here initially low score. And depending on the SES, you can see how in this study, actually, the SES was highly influential, affecting later on whether you ended up with a higher ranking or lower ranking. Well, this is just for us to... There's a Feinstein is the original paper, and I don't know more about this study, so just to remind us that we should dig more into this issue. Okay, so gene-environment interaction. How does this relate? So we have been looking at brain results. We could talk many hours about behavioral results and so on. But I think that the important point for us at this point is to realize that there are perhaps three different ways, at least, or maybe more, how genes could affect our behavior. And one is that genes would determine our developmental path. And we know that this is the case, for example, for our eye color. I'm blue-eyed, not because the water I was drinking, even it has been clean all the time here in Finland, or the other things. It's just my genes, basically. But not so, perhaps, for cognition or emotional development. Then we could say that there's environmental support or the lack that will determine the limits of learning. Is this right? So because my mother was not talking enough to me, I develop language problems. There is a third way also, and this is so-called, and if we talk about now specifically, not genetic and what the environment interaction is, that there's so-called evocative gene-environment interaction. And it means that genetic factors affect to what kind of environments I will kind of end up, and also how the environment actually behaves with me, how they my parents treat me. It depends on my genetic architecture. So, for example, if I'm always smiling, easy child, parents have easy time, you know, with me, and they probably give me only positive feedback and so on. But if I'm a difficult child, crying a lot, then I will get this type of interaction from the parents. And this could be, for example, taken to the temperament, or I would see how the organism actually is oriented towards the stimuli in the environment. So a shy person, for example, would try to avoid other people, and this, if not encouraged by the parents in a different way, would perhaps lead to a withdrawn child until the child at some point starts to understand, okay, needs to behave a bit differently. Or problems in speech perception, genetically driven, might perhaps lead to the fact that kids becomes overloaded by hearing stories, for example, and hearing language. And so they probably try to avoid shared book reading events, and there's a complex interaction then with the environment. Well, I think I skip this, and just show one slide here. So in this Jyväskylä Longitude study of dyslexia, we also measured behavioral measures and speech kind of phonemic length perception. And we found out that out of our dyslexics, there were about one-third who had problems, if we define a problem being minus 1.25 standard deviation below, like the typical population. In phoneme duration discrimination, we found that about a bit higher percentage had problems with the verbal short-term memory. And then we found that also this rapid serial naming that predicts actually reading very well later on, about 31% at the second grade had slower naming speed. So what does this picture tell us? So we have three major, if you think that this represents also the, perhaps the phonological processing, not fully. Now, we have three major predictors and cognitive precursors for reading and dyslexia. What does this mean to you about in terms of multifactorial perspective? This is in accordance to me with the Pennington's idea that no single deficit can explain dyslexia, for example. And actually, interestingly, there's also one-third of these dyslexics about that do not have in any of these skills any problems or not below this level. So they must have some other problems. So dyslexia, even in our transparent language, is caused by several possible factors that explain the reading problems. And if you take then those from the risk sample that became typical readers, they were a bigger sample, you can see that only 4.5% have RAN problems, is more or less what would be perhaps in the typical population. And none of these problems was higher percentage, almost 60%. So there's clearly different types of profiles that will determine you becoming dyslexic or not. Okay, I will actually skip this proof by, because this you all seem to be a bit tired already and it would take some more thinking. So you can go through this by yourselves later on. But Bruce Pennington tested now this single deficit model and multiple deficit models. And I just mentioned you that the models were five models, single deficit subtypes, phonological core plus something else, multiple deficit predictor model. And then he had so-called hybrid model. That means that people could have either one single predictor or they needed two or more predictors. And we skip this and mention only that the best model they found was that the hybrid model. So substantial number of dyslexic individuals will fit to single deficit model, but substantial numbers fit multiple deficit models. So the result reject in their view strict single deficit version of phonological processing problems being like core deficit for all dyslexics. Okay. Well, now this is the final evidence, the point in my discussion here, and this is cognitive skill profiles in typical development. These guys, I'm not going to explain this slide, just show to you, they used so-called graph theory, and then they went on to study also the confirmatory factor analysis for several type of cognitive test battery. And I don't even remember now which test whether, but they were the typical tests where you can get a factors like inhibition, working memory, arousal activation, response variability, temporal information processing, memory span, and processing speed. So very typical cognitive profile measured in many, many studies. Now, the interesting point in this study was that if they actually used also this type of graph theory and trying to come up with the different neuropsychological profiles, that they saw that they also exist actually in these typically developing persons. and not only in ADHD kids. So if you take all typically developing children, all ADHDs across all of these tasks, you can see that ADHDs tended to be kind of a poorer at the overall level. But then there were profiles also in typically developing children that followed very closely the same profiles. There were some differences. So the question then remains, we come back to our original question, are these, if such profiles exist, and if it's such a complex system, are then these different neurocognitive disorders, are they only then dimensions, like a lower end of one dimension, let's say phonological skills, or let's say your access to your, like in the what rapid automatic naming perhaps measures, access to lexicon. So you happen to have, you happen to be only, there's nothing else, just a, at the lower level. And then we would need to start to think about how does it, how do we see this at the brain level? And that might be important from our research point of view. Can't even remember what I have next. Okay, I will skip this. It's also a bit too complicated picture. Okay. Yes, I was asking this question. Now, I just show you one picture here, and we would need to have more evidence. But this was an interesting one of early findings. We have not even published this yet. So here we have on this axis, here we have also Z-score typically using because it puts all in the same scale. So here we have a language score at 3 and 5 years. It's a composite score of many, many different language tests. And then we have this brain amplitude at 600 milliseconds. It's for the deviant atta, long atta at 600 milliseconds. And then we look at the correlations. So what do we find here? This is the left hemisphere, and this is right hemisphere. Yes, at T4, T3 site, and T4 site. And you can see that at both hemispheres, the correlation is in the opposite direction in the between the at risks and controls. So I think that this suggests to me that it's not only just the, like at the one end, that they otherwise the brain is similar, they are just not functioning as well. To me, this suggests that there is different organization of the brain. So the system overall works differently, and maybe it's due to the cascading effects starting from the early development onwards. Okay, and then I think that genetic factors and complex gene environment and gene interactions then relate to this type of different cognitive processing atypicalities. And I guess this could be then what we would kind of summarize in visually. So we have this genetic variation, and we have environment playing a role affecting different types of neural developmental level, and at the neural system level we have brain level risk factors, and then they would be related to different cognitive level skills. And here we could write, instead of like inaccurate reading, maybe some of these could be like language problems or some other behavioral problems. Okay, so this is an illustration, the kind almost my postscript. So we have different cognitive profile. I once tried to visualize this, and it is, I'm not satisfied yet with this picture, but nevertheless, it take something. Let's assume that here is the mean, and here are the good performance, and here's the low performance. And this is a dyslexic guy, and we have different type of cognitive domains. Here we have emotions. So this guy may be good in the emotional processing, average in logical reasoning. Speech processing might be poor, and visomotor skills. And then synesthetics, he might be actually quite good. Linguistic skills, perhaps also poor. Visuospatial skills might be okay. And tactile skills, perhaps even a bit of average. Then, actually, we have also people in terms of their motor problems. And it's just another skill, actually, although not recognized in the society. And this guy might have a bit different profile. So his problems might be more here in the tactile, and we don't know, just something picked up. And so there's a very complex interaction between genes and environment that leads to these different profiles. And then you have one student that have a certain type of profile, and then you have another student that has a different type of profile. And therefore, I would then, my postscript here, end note would be that from the neurocognitive and genetic point of view, these individual differences, even in our genome and so on, I think that they are part of typical variation in mankind. So this, we should think of normality perhaps a bit differently. What is abnormal? It's normal for us as mankind to have these genetic small variations and the multiple what we find out. Now, it just happens to be that reading was important. If music and playing piano would be important, and that would be the kind of way up to climb the ladder in the society, I would be somewhere else, sure. If piano playing was the key point. But reading instead of music and finding musicals are important in society. So normality or deviation from it, is it good or bad or not just different type of variation? Just to kind of to think about this as the final thing, but yeah, so I don't even want to give an answer for the question that I ask about the multidimensionality, but just I encourage you to take a look at yourself and make your own conclusions. And this was my good friend Chris Bartlett, who's a molecular genetist in Children's Nationswide's Ohio Hospital, leading his own group there, and he was thinking also about this thing, and he gave me this picture. So he has a learning difficulty, but it also he tried to somehow depict also these multiple levels of genes, brain, and environment. And I liked it because it had good colors. So thank you for your attention. And patience. Staying awake. Most of you stayed awake very well. So, so Jarmo, what's next? Actually, this would be right point to thank the organizing committee. Don't blame me because I've not been doing too much. So Jarmo has been the main person in charge. Then have Kaisa, and we have had our ESRs, all from Predictable and from Childbrain, from Jyväskylä, Orsi, Natalia, Nasla was involved, Weyong, Praka, and Sam. So let's give big upload now already.